Dan Schneider is an American poet and critic of literature and film. He is the founder of Cosmoetica, one of the world's most influential and popular websites regarding the arts. The concept of truth, it's a very problematic notion in general, historically in philosophy, also in the contemporary world, especially with the ascendancy of science in terms of science has almost gotten this automatic cachet when it comes to the domain of truth, that science explicitly deals with truth and reality. It's also twinned with logic in mathematics. For example, 4 + 4 is 8. It's just true that it is. It's just true that the Earth rotates around the sun. But in art, it's slightly different. Perhaps it's by definition impossible to get at objective truth, and it might be more subjective. But what do you think the relationship between art and truth is, and whether there is one?
I would say that science and journalism deal with truth and art deals with reality. And there's a fundamental difference there. And it's not just a nitpicky kind of difference. And I'll give you an example. It's reality and it's factual that Tony Sobrato is Skyping and interviewing Dan Schneider. The statement, Tony Sobrato is Skyping and interviewing Dan Schneider, is either true and false. So truth is always a comment upon reality. It isn't reality itself. And I think a lot of artists confuse this because, you know, especially if you're liberal-minded, which most people in the arts tend to be, we want to sort of take the ethical or moral upper hand against those lousy politicians or other enterprises that don't claim to deal with truth. And I think it does a disservice to art because a similar thing, if I can just digress, you know, we artists always like to talk about beauty, but art isn't about beauty either. Art is communication. Art is more a verb than a noun. Art is how we do something. If I, say, want to tell a story about a character that's dealing with some trauma in their life, their wife left them, their mother got cancer, their dog just got hit by a truck, that's the theme. That's the narrative. But how I tell this, whether I decide that a character is going to be likable or unlikable, whether I'm going to have the tragedy occur a third of the way in or 80% in, that's how the art is projected. So art, to me, is not so much the thing, the message, the philosophy, but it's how it is projected. Philosophy is ideas. Art is ideas in motion, in that how we're going to do that. Think of any philosopher. A philosopher, you can maybe boil down to 10 or 20 major apothems, maxims that you could say, this is the essential Nietzsche. This is the essential so-and-so, going back to the Greeks. But art is how it's conveyed. And so for me, art is always how we translate reality. It's not about truth. It's about, okay, I'm dealing with a story about a woman with breast cancer. How am I going to portray that? Because art comes from the Latin ars, you know, ars gratia artis, or whatever is the famous, I think it's on Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's, the film company's headers, you know, is that it comes from, art comes from the same root as artifice, which is artificial, which means it cannot be truth. It can deal with sometimes truth, but it's more or less, I think, dealing with reality.
I've heard similar arguments in terms of the role, the power, and the potential limitations of art. So one aspect that I appreciate there is that art is about the communication, the expression of the idea. It's not fundamentally about the idea itself. But then there are possibly logical problems with that. So if art isn't going to communicate truth, but it will communicate reality, that can be problematic because how could something be real if it's not true? If you look at statements, some controversial political statements. I mean, art can say whatever it wants to say. Sometimes an artist deliberately doesn't want to say anything and he wants you to interpret that completely by yourself. I'm giving an extreme example from Hollywood, which is someone like David Lynch, who doesn't basically set out a narrative to his project. He's like, I'm not saying what this film's about. You can make up your own idea, which is fine. Then you get explicit statements. So if you think of someone like Banksy, who is communicated in general what you would see as an anti-corporate, anti-elitist position, both economically and politically. He's depicting a form of reality, but the artist behind that who's depicting this form of reality is saying that this particular aspect of reality is true. It's true to these artists that there is social and economic deprivation and it's corporate power that holds back aspects of social progression. And in that respect, they're making a statement about how the social world and the world of the inhabited human with cognitive faculties in that world operates. So they're kind of marrying their aspect of truth and reality in that respect.
Well, there's a difference between quote-unquote political or religious or philosophical truths that we accept. Let me give you an example versus reality. People talk about rights from the Magna Carta on until, America's Bill of Rights. And people will talk about, well, I have the right for A, B, C, or D. And here in America, we have, I think, 27 amendments to our Constitution currently. And people complain about our Supreme Court creating rights out of thin air. I would assume it's similar in the UK. I'm not up on the British parliamentary or judicial system, but I would assume it's true that every so often people probably do complain. Well, you know, now someone has been granted a right for this here in the U.S. You know, homosexual marriage just was ratified, I believe, last year, or maybe earlier this year, in fact. But rights are fictions. They are useful fictions. They are things that can have a positive outlook. But a right only exists as long as we're able to defend it. Imagine a science fiction scenario that has played out many times in films and radio and television programs, that a superior culture comes and they decide that humans taste good, or that they want slaves to work in their mines or something. Now, hopefully, an advanced society that could have faster than light interstellar travel will be beyond such means, but we have no idea. Human beings, we could say, well, we have here in America the so-and-so rights, or the, you know, British citizens have the right to this or whatever. That's not going to mean a thing to any people or any creatures that have greater power. So there's an example of things we hold these truths to be self-evident, as it says here in the U.S. Constitution, but they're not really truths. I mean, it is a falsehood. Rights are fictions, and again, they are useful. They are good things, but that doesn't make them reality. So again, we can talk about, you can talk about a David Lynch film, you can talk about the truth that someone has, but if you and I, Tony, were sitting in a room, and this has been shown in laboratory studies many times, where they've set things up, a professor is giving a lecture about some arcane subject, and there are 100 college students listening to the arcane lecture. All of a sudden, in bursts into the room someone who steals his backpack or steals his notes or something and runs out. Bang, lights go on, and someone says, okay, this was just an experiment. To all 100 people, they give a questionnaire and they say, was it a male or female intruder? What was taken? What wasn't taken? Did the person exit stage left or stage right? And you will look at the 100 responses and you'll get, you know, maybe 10 people will say, well, it was a woman with reddish hair. Another 20 people will say, well, they exited stage left. All of these people have observed the exact same thing, but they will have totally different truths. So when we talk about truth in reality, what we are, we're using truth as a euphemism for reality rather than reality itself. And human beings, at least here in the U.S., most human testimony is pretty much thrown out. Judges, lawyers, the legal system here in the U.S. pretty much has gotten to the point where, you know, we can't take that. In fact, in the U.S., there have been hundreds, I think several hundred men released in the last decade or two because DNA has confirmed that they didn't rape or attack their victims. And yet these people, you know, imagine a woman has been raped. You would think that a woman would never forget the face of her attacker being raped and being violated. But it happens. And someone has pointed out, especially when you're talking, say, cross-ethnic or cross-racial identification. Let's say if you had a white woman who was raped by a black attacker, you know, it's a lot more difficult to go to a lineup and say, well, it was that black. No, it was that guy. And DNA doesn't lie. DNA, you know, as long as someone doesn't flub something in the lab, is far more reliable than human memory. So I would question the very claims of people, especially artists. And artists are, we're born liars, as Federico Fellini was wont to say. Artists, by their nature, liars. And so when when an artist says, I'm a truth teller, don't take them for their word. So I would just question the idea of truths, especially when put in up to a political contest, because truths are manipulated for the benefit of a political party, an individual political person, a cause, even groups that I may agree with, groups like, say, Greenpeace or environmentalist groups or groups that are against a lot of the GMO, genetically modified foods. They tend to sometimes lie or exaggerate things for the greater political cause that they support. So I'm very careful when someone says to me, I'm a truth teller, because my natural bullshit detector goes off.
There is a certain distinction to be made. When you define and conceptualize the difference between reality and truth in the example that you just gave, such as there is a reality being formed in terms of there's someone that's run into a lecture hall, they've stolen a bag and then they've run out in a particular direction, and then people that are observing that, the truth to them is that they may have gone left or right, or they may have forgotten, or they can't remember clearly, and the person may have been wearing a red jacket, someone else said it might have been wearing an orange jacket. That depicts to you the difference between actual reality as an underpinning ontological aspect in itself, and then the truth that people put on that reality as subjects of a subjective world. But with that in mind, it's also important to distinguish between a social and a natural reality, and that would be my point about where reality and truth both converge. So for example, it's under a naturalistic method of science and truth, it would be impossible to deny that the assailant really did walk in with a bag, he picked up the bag, he ran out the left. This would be recorded by a camera, which is an indisputable fact of the natural world. But then on top of that, because there are human observers in the room, they have interpreted or depicted that differently, or they can't recall all the details. So they now perceive that it's true that the attacker went left when he really went right, but that's still true to them. And now they've got their own form of a social reality to it, but it doesn't actually take away from the aspect of what the real naturalistic reality is underpinning that. And it's an old debate that you still see fleshed out today in the theist atheist debate, which is essentially that people inhabit the same naturalistic world, but one person's reality to them and their truth to them is that God is the creator of this universe, as where someone who's an atheist observes similar facts or similar data but says no, the underlying reality is this naturalistic world, but you think that because you've put your truth and your own reality over this naturalistic world that's reality to you, as where the naturalists are saying no, there's one reality, and if you put something else on top of it, that's fine, it doesn't take the fact away that there's particles and quantum mechanics underlying it. And that's a position that I'm sure as you as well, it's like the fundamentality of realism in philosophy, which is regardless of what the human subject thinks or perceives or correlates in their own mind, even with observable data, there is a real world that exists independently of that mind. And that would be the example of the correct direction as recorded by the camera of where the assailant left the lecture hall. But to an individual, it's true to them that they went the other way from just bad memory or bad perception, and that's their social reality. And that's a big aspect in terms of the social natural sciences for me personally, and across the wider debate, that, like you're saying, these notions of rights, liberty, equality, freedom, aspects of the constructed subject throughout history, they are subjective and they have their own truth, but it then carries its own social reality. So it is now considered a social reality that all men are created equal, and that's a different kind of reality to what naturalists would say, where it doesn't matter what political or social climate we lived in, there was always a natural world before it, and they don't really care a lot about what the social reality is. And that's an important philosophical distinction that carries into the social world, especially when we live in a world where we inhabit it as social creatures, but we seem to live in a natural world with its own laws.
And Tony, you know, it should be pointed out too that a lot of people overlook the fact that not only as individual human beings, but as human societies, we have limits. Mm-hmm. We are mortal. We have, I think, there are five known grand senses, and people have come up with maybe a half a dozen other minor senses that human beings have. But think about some of the animals that we know in the animal world, or even plants that trope towards the sun. there could possibly be dozens of sensory abilities that have developed in creatures on just our planet alone, not to mention possible alien worlds. How do we know, for example, what reality is if we have maybe only a dozen senses out of a possible infinite amount of senses? It could very well be, for example, that when we talk about things in modern physics, dark energy or dark matter, that we are talking about things that are perfectly natural, easily explicable, if you have senses and machines derived from those senses to enhance those senses in an alien intelligence. How do we know, for example, that time as we experience it is real, or, you know, that's reality? It could be that time is somehow circular, that there could be creatures that experience all kinds of things in different ways. So that's what I mean when I talk about truth and whatnot. I try to get it to the most elemental thing. Yes, I'm perfectly willing as an individual to accept that because someone has browner skin than I am, or because someone has breasts rather than a penis, or that because someone believes that there's some grand creator, artificer out there, and I'm an agnostic, that we are equal as people. But generally, when we say that, what we really mean is equal under the eyes of the law, human law.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And also your point there, which is generally an instrumentalist argument, which is essentially we can only really perceive or interpret or construct the world with the tools that we've got, either physical tools or mental cognitive tools. This is an idea that goes back to Kant. And that's a very interesting point that, for example, that you mentioned about time, or if we measure something at its most basic level of particle physics, there's a problematic inbuilt structure into the way our logical mind works. So we tend to work with cause and effect, which is a symmetrical experience of time, but it's not impossible by definition, and many philosophers have contemplated the idea of reverse causation, or the way that an effect can actually preclude a cause. It's not impossible under the mathematics of quantum physics, but unfortunately the way we deal with data in our minds, we can only really work in a symmetrical nature. So you're right to point out to the fact that we've only got these limited senses, and we could be tapping into aspects of reality, but we're at the end of the day limited by the tools we've got. I mean, we can't, as humans with everyday experience, we can't perceive that the conversation we're having right now happened yesterday. It's just not possible for us to sense that. But it doesn't mean in some kind of dimension or aspect of time and reality and mathematics, it doesn't mean it's not possible. So that's an interesting point about any kind of philosophical exposition when you're dealing with the nature of reality.
And, you know, people will talk sometimes, and I've had this conversation with many artists, you know, that somehow art is, and I've said it translates reality, but what is the purpose of life or existence and whatnot? I think, for example, personally, that we choose that. I, you, Tony, any listener to your program will make a conscious choice to choose. I believe in free will. I ask people, I'll say, well, what could life's or existence meaning possibly be? I mean, if we posit, for example, that we're just holographic projections in some cosmic school child's experiment, well, does that mean that, you know, if you're behind on your mortgage, that's going to essentially change? If I'm stuck in a traffic jam, is my frustration going to be any less knowing that I'm part of some grand experiment with computronics, or whether, you know, or, you know, there comes a point, for example, that we have to accept that there's either nothing or there's something. And human beings, speaking of limited, we have a hell of a difficult time with big concepts like deep time or like nothingness. When we think of nothingness, we think of a black void, but that's not nothing. That's blackness. What is absolute nothingness? It is very hard for we peeled apes, as the poet Robinson Jeffers would call human beings, to understand what nothingness is. So we make up these elaborate games. I always say, though, if we look at the old idea of turtles upon turtles upon turtles upon turtles going down infinitely, at some level, and it's infinity minus one, there is some base reality. So even if at that base level, someone is making a computer program, and then some creature in that program is making a program, making a program, making a program, making a program, and we're, you know, 3,285,117 realities away from the base reality, there's still a fundamental reality there, because computers are real, as we know in our experience. And so if the computer has some base reality, so does the things within that model. And whether this is the dream of Vishnu or it's a computer reality, we still have some kind of base reality.
Fundamentally, there are different aspects of whether one's a realist or an anti-realist. I think essentially there is one fundamental reality, whether one's a naturalist or isn't a naturalist, or believes in kind of a divine creator, or just believes that this is a simulation by aliens or by someone else in the universe. There is a base reality, but it's this old Kantian problem of whether we'll ever be able to tap into that reality. And perhaps tools and a data we use is instrumentalist, as we paint pictures of reality into the stuff we see, and therefore reality that we can conceive of is projected by us onto the world. Doesn't say anything about the reality that's really there, because that's just a limitation of us. But the fact that we tend to exist in our minds, and we tend to see the natural world around us that seems to exist independent of us, and whether it's a simulation, whether it's a hoax by an alien somewhere, whether it's a god, or whether it's multiple dimensions all married and warped together through different laws of physics and time, there seems to be a fundamental base reality. And that's a problem that you can't seem to escape when you philosophize over these issues. Even the school of idealism, which says that everything is essentially a mental construct and that nothing exists except for the mind, and tables and chairs and other people aren't really there, and an extreme form of solipsism, even that reduces it down to one fundamental reality, i.e. the reality of the idealistic mental state. So it's hard to divorce any form of experience existence from some sort of fundamental reality.
And we may simply not ever know that as well. We have to accept that there could be things that are simply beyond human ken. I'd like to believe that we will take control of ourselves through positive eugenics, through the use of the merging of mind and machine. I'm not a believer in that Ray Kurzweil singularity kind of stuff, but I think eventually human beings will take control of their evolution. But we are not gods, and as imperfect beings, we may not ever be able to make or perfect something to the sense that we will be all-knowing, and there could be limits to our knowledge. We have to accept that.
What would you say is some of the mysteries and potential perplexities regarding consciousness and what it is to think and feel and observe the world? Now, this is an idea obviously popular throughout history in art and obviously in the thinking. In the modern world, it's kind of two opposing schools, although many thinkers lean to the way of materialism. I assume you know the hard problem of consciousness.
Well, I mean, the idea of qualia, and people will often talk about, you know, do you see a red stop sign? And I assume stop signs are red in Britain as well as here in America. Is your red really what I would call purple? You know, why, for example, just to put it on a human level, if you and I both went out for a stroll down, you know, the lane, or if we were both judging a beauty contest for women, you know, you might like women with big booty, as they say. I may like women who are more athletic. You may prefer darker skinned women. I may prefer women who come from Asia, that kind of thing. And why is that, though? I mean, there may be, you know, I talked about the limits of knowledge. There could be just what I call just because answers to things, is that you can't get to the root of something. I don't know your age, Tony, but back about 50 years ago, there was this great television show called The Prisoner, Patrick McGoohan. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It was about an ex-spy who was on an island, and every week he tried to escape, and he was brought back by his captors, who seemed to be almost all-powerful. In the end, it turns out that he is his own captor in his own mind. And the thing with that show is, it has this circularity, but there's one great episode called The General, and this was filmed in 1967, and they had these giant room-sized computers back then, and The General is supposedly a machine that can answer any question. And at the end of the show, the character named Number 6, played by Patrick McGoohan, one of the great actors of the television era, he fries the computer, and the captors say, "How the hell did you do that?" And he typed in three letters, W-H-Y. And that's the one question that really is beyond scientific purview. Why does anything happen? Why, you know, why are we talking right now? Why is the sky blue? I mean, we can give scientific reasons and say, well, the sky is blue because, you know, all the other colors are absorbed except the blueness by the stuff that's in the atmosphere. But then you can say, well, why is that stuff absorbed and blueness not? And then you can go through scientific explanations, but you go back to this infinite regress, and there may just very well be reasons. Assuming, let's say, the cosmos did begin with a big bang, what happened before it? Why? Why was there something before it if there was something before it? If we live in a multiple universe, why is it a multiple universe? You know, these are the kinds of questions that existentially may have no real answer, and we just, you know, are just pawing our way out there to get these kinds of answers.
I mean, it doesn't stop people trying to find the answers to it. I mean, there's a whole...
Oh, they shouldn't.
Yeah, there's a whole plethora of academics and researchers working on it. But, I mean, essentially, there are certain conundrums in life, and the more science tends to delve into this stuff, especially the beginning exploration of the universe, the more we seek answers, the more questions kind of come up. So it could be the case that we might just never know certain things, and I think a lot of people would be quite content with knowing that, especially when you look at some of the puzzling equations from theoretical physics and what it actually says, especially about the creation of the Big Bang or inflationary theory, that there could be many inflations going on simultaneously. We could live in a multiverse. We could live in one occupied for many different forms of string theory. Essentially, we could never know, and we just keep pressing this guessing game. And to a certain extent, that's why I empathize with the anti-realist camp in general, which is essentially we come up with a discourse and a perpetuation of reality and truth, but then we move the goalposts to the right a bit more, and then we have to go and delve into this more, and then the theory changed itself, and then the reality changed itself. And I mean, one great example throughout history is gravity. Its conception has changed from Isaac Newton to Einstein, but it's still depicting the same thing, but simultaneously it's not. So I mean, these theories and ideas about the nature of reality in the universe constantly change in light of new theories and evidence, and it's just as soon as you try and put one hand on it, it kind of slips out of the other hand. So it's possible that we might have to resign ourselves to the fact that we'll never know, but it doesn't mean that we can't progress in certain areas, make other theories and ideas obsolete. And I suppose that's one of the powerful aspects of art, because it delves in that area of the ambiguous and the mysterious, and it can utilize these unknowns and then put it in another area where, just by the basic aspect of intrigue and asking questions, it can make the mysterious more palatable and can communicate it to people. So that's like, for me personally, one of the powerful roles of art.
You talked about gravity, and you know, when I think of the double split experiment which proved that light can be a wave or a particle, gravity is one of those things that we thought was the warp of space-time, and famously demonstrated in Carl Sagan's Cosmos show, which I think you've seen in the UK or has been on the UK, you know, that if you took like a pool ball, a billiard ball, and rolled it on a surface that sinks with the weight of the balls, that gravity is simply space-time warping. Other people have proposed that there are things called gravitons. People have even proposed that consciousness is a fundamental particle called a conchon. I don't know how this would work, but these are the kinds of things that are interesting. And, you know, it could be that everything is very eloquent, that there is a grand theory of everything, a grand unified theory, or a theory of everything that describes all these things. As relates to the arts, one of the things that I find in the arts troubling, and also outside of the arts, is what I call sialism, or this pretend knowledge that we find online in things like Wikipedia, which is filled with bad information, that you can listen to experts on YouTube that misspell words or don't even understand the things they're talking about. When I deal with artists, for example, one of the things I try to talk to, especially young people who write me, and I get probably 2,000 emails a week from people sending me things to look at or asking me questions, is that what I call the divine inspiration fallacy. One of the reasons I think a lot of artists always find a rivalry isn't necessarily that they disagree with each other on a philosophic level, but there's an inherent envy that some artists have that another artist succeeds. It's this Schadenfreude that people have, that if I wrote a great sonnet and someone else didn't, that I must somehow be cheating. And I think it's because they have this idea that creativity comes from God, that somehow there's X amount of creative things out there. And if I pluck something down and wrote a great sonnet, or you pluck something down and wrote or produced a great film, and another person plucks something down and paints a great painting, that there are three less possible routes or ways for people to be great out there, that somehow that other artist has taken something that I could have had. And I think this pettiness that you often see in artists, and you see it in great artists, like filmmaker like Ingmar Bergman said a lot of nasty things about Michelangelo Antonioni, a filmmaker that shared a lot of philosophical things with him. But it's clear that Bergman's anger or resentment towards Antonioni was something deeper. And I think it's because that a lot of these artists, especially when they're great artists, sometimes resent another great artist doing something that they wish they could have done. And I think that's a part of the larger silism in society with things like Wikipedia. For example, I do these YouTube interviews, and I was doing one before I did your show. And, you know, you see things like Vsauce or some of these YouTube channels that sometimes will have great videos that explain things, but they sometimes leave things out historically. They sometimes flub things because they don't have fact checkers. These are individuals doing these YouTube videos. One of the people that I sometimes cringe, even though I subscribe to his channel, is this British philosopher, Alain de Botton, who does a channel called The School of Life. And one of the reasons that I find a lot of his videos troubling, probably 9 out of 10 of them troubling, every 10th one he hits something on the money, is that it seems to me that he's putting out a lot of false information or information that is more personal than he will admit in his videos about something. And I think that has a negative effect. And like I said, something like Wikipedia is probably the biggest problem on the internet in terms of putting out false information, because I can talk in some length on the arts with a good deal of expertise. I spent decades in the arts. But if I was to write about post-Soviet politics in Romania, what the hell would I need to edit an article on Wikipedia about for? That's ridiculous. Here's a term that I came up with, a logical fallacy that I think I'm the only person that's ever pointed this out. I call it the zookeeper fallacy. And I see it all the time, not just in science, not just in art, but in day-to-day living. Imagine that you're a zookeeper at a zoo in London here, and you take care of, say, the big cats department, you know, the lions and the tigers and whatnot. And every day you have to go feed them. You have to lure them away to clean out the poop and the excrement and the urine that they leave. And you're doing this for 10, 15, 20, 25 years before you retire. The zookeeper here is going to think, well, you know, I know a hell of a lot about cats. I've known Leo and his brood, his little pride. I saw this panther grow up. I've seen this cheetah since he was a cub or a kitten, whatever they call cheetah youth. And this guy is going to say, you know, I'm going to go on vacation and go to Africa, and I'm going to see these big cats. So he goes, he takes a trip to South Africa or Zimbabwe or wherever, and he goes out onto the hike, and he says, you know, I know all about lions. I've dealt with lions and cheetahs for the last 25 years, and I know that they won't do this sort of thing. So he arrogantly goes out, and then he's mauled to death. And the reason he's mauled to death by one of these big cats is because he has assumed that the tamed, domesticated, fat and sassy big cats that he's known in the artificial environment of the zoo are just like they are in nature. And what happens is someone like Botton, who I think from what I've read of him, grew up in a wealthy family, grew up in the upper crust, went to all the finest boarding schools or whatnot. I find probably his worst videos are those where he espouses a way of life, whether it's art or therapy. He has this sort of quasi-communistic view of, he has a video called The Perfect Nation or The Perfect Society that I think is an Orwellian nightmare. But he has no clue about this because he's the zookeeper who has lived in this very circumscribed, very privileged little section of human society. And when he tries to think that the old fat, sassy cats that he's dealt with are like reality, there's a big difference. And so I call that the zookeeper fallacy. And that's what Botton and I think a lot of people online who do a lot of these sometimes good channels, other size other times bad YouTube channels dealing with whether it's unexplained phenomena or whether it's history or whatnot. They focus too much on what they're saying on their own personal experience without getting to something objective. And I am someone who believes in objectivity. I'm not perfectly objective, but at least I strive for it. I'll give you an example. When I was 6 years old in 1971, I drowned in a lake in Forest, called Forest Lake in New Hampshire. And when I was drowning, you know, I had the thing where I had what would be called an out-of-body experience. I was looking up and I could see my body sort of floating in the water. And I had this kind of experience. I'll just make it brief. If you've ever read, there's a story or an urban legend or a myth called like the Green Children of Woolpit. And it's about these children that were found in a cave that supposedly came from another dimension. And people have thought that this myth was somehow, you'll find it written about in many different books about, you know, contact with different dimensions. And I had met a similar type experience where I met children in this, what I consider a dream, but at the time I thought it was reality, that were greenish and came from a cave. And for many years, until my late teen years, I thought, oh, this was reality. But as I aged, I got to recognize that if you're drowning and not enough oxygen is going to your brain, you're going to have this out-of-body experience where you see a light or something, and that maybe there was some kind of cultural memory. I had never heard of this Green Children mythos, but maybe I had heard about it somewhere. Someone had mentioned it. Or maybe it is part of something called a racial memory, and I tapped into it in that second or two that maybe I extrapolated out into being a 20-minute encounter or whatever it might have been. But very few people have the ability to step back and say, whether it's in day-to-day things or whether it's these things that are in extremis like drowning, what did I experience? Was it real or am I imbuing something into it? And I think when you have the ability to step back and say, you know, I'm not perfect. I'm as subject to illusions or hallucinations or delusions as anyone else, you can better approach the world as a person and an artist. And I think a lot of people don't have that. So I just wanted to bring that up. As far as Cosmoetica, I have generally, it's been a popular website. I started that in 2001, and I still get probably something like 70 million people who visit it a year. But the thing is, the lowest common denominator has taken over in the last few years in the sense that people aren't reading as much. So even though every year I still get a few more million hits in terms of reading or visitors, it's sort of because more people are coming online in India or China. For example, I get inundated with submissions of terrible poetry from India. Indian MFA programs are horrendous. They have the worst writers going. But I've tried to focus in the last couple of years on my YouTube channel where I'm interviewing people and trying to do that. The problem is since videos, there's no technology that can go, you can Google and say, this actor talks about that role in a film because Google can look on the things that I've written in word form and find keyword things. You don't have that with videos. And Cosmoetica came a couple of years, 2-3 years before blogs sort of came into business and everyone was writing online. So I sort of rode a wave of that. And Cosmoetica, I get kids in their teens and early 20s who said they've been reading my website for 15, 20 years. It's been much, much more difficult. And I knew it would be difficult with the videos to get it as popular because I'm coming in 7, 8, 10 years after videos hit it big. And I'm doing videos that are 90 to 120 minutes plus long about deeper topics. I'm not just writing a 3-minute or producing a 3-minute cartoon where Albert Einstein is a cute chipmunk explaining E equals MC squared. That stuff will get 25 million hits in a year. You know, so I'm only getting a few hundred hits. I wish that people would listen to two intelligent people, an interviewer and an interviewee, talk for 2 hours about the art of acting or about the nature of reality or the life of a Charlie Chaplin or the life of this scientist or that scientist. But it's very difficult. I have started this Actors on Acting series, and hopefully I've gotten 13 of them. Hopefully I will get some more famous actors eventually who will see the quality, and hopefully they will bring new viewers.